Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the telephone line is my mother, Caroline Kilburn.
Good morning, everyone.
So, what have we got today for our listeners, Mom?
Well, today we have a very interesting book. It's an historical novel and one that everyone should read because it's, well, you'll find out after the interview. But our author is Jennifer Rosner, and she's the author of the novel Once We Were Home and The Yellow Bird Sings, a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. The memoir of a tree, If a Tree Falls, a family's quest to hear and be heard about raising her deaf daughters in a hearing, speaking world, and the children's book, The Mitten String. Really interesting books. I'm looking forward to reading some of them. And she has studied philosophy at Columbia and Stanford and lives in Western Massachusetts with her family. And welcome to Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much.
And Jennifer, how's the weather out there?
It is currently snowing quite a lot. It's been snowing all day. And as you know, I worried about us losing power, but we haven't. So I'm knocking on wood.
That's great. Yeah. Just for anyone listening to this, because who knows, you know, with the wonders of internet, you might be listening to this at any time of the year, but we're recording this in April. So an April snowstorm, while not completely out of the question, is a little bit unusual. And especially because we basically already had, at least if Massachusetts is anything like Iowa, we've had spring twice already.
Exactly. this snow is covering the tulips and the crocuses. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And I don't know about the fruit trees this year, how they're going to, seemed like they were all starting to bud out and then they got smashed again. So hopefully we still have apples and pears and peaches and plums and cherries. So, Jennifer, Once We Were Home is a novel about children who were sent into hiding, Jewish children sent into hiding during World War II, and then what happens in the aftermath. How did you stumble upon this, you know, kind of the concept for this novel?
So I had been interviewing a lot of hidden children of the Holocaust for my first novel, The Yellow Bird Sings. And there was a man who suggested I talk to his wife. She hadn't been hidden, but she had actually been in a Siberian labor camp during the war. And when she returned to her native village, you know, village in Poland, she learned that something like just 3% of Jewish children had survived. And most of them were in Christian settings with assumed identities and fake names. And there was this mission that grew to try to retrieve those children and bring them back into the Jewish fold. And for, you know, for many reasons, because, you know, so many had been lost and the children were kind of, you know, considered the future, but also because, you know, they thought of it as honoring the last wishes of the parents who perished, because the parents, you know, put them into hiding to survive and they hoped they'd come back and get them. And then they didn't survive, but they didn't intend that they would just live their life, you know, growing up in a Christian family. They had wanted to raise them in their own faith. And so there was this kind of feeling of a moral imperative to get them back into Judaism. And finally, it was still so anti-Semitic after the war. There was this fear that even if the families they were harbored with were loving, there was this worry about the villagers and other neighbors, et cetera. And so there was a lot of pressure to try to get the children back. But I found it really kind of morally blurry because I felt like these little children had been they had lost their first family. They got stowed in this other family. And then they were bonding with them for sometimes 4 years during the war and they were getting cared for, et cetera. And then after that, they were taken again. And so there were just numerous ruptures in their lives. And I was really interested in studying this, you know, this sort of what they were left with, sense of identity, sense of home, how you connect to another person after this, et cetera. And while it is true that there's a storyline of Jewish children hidden in Christian settings, in fact, you know, and Jewish, you know, operatives coming to get them back, there's also a storyline of a child who when relatives do come to get him, the church actually takes him on the run and tries to keep him with Christianity. And then finally, there's a storyline about a non-Jewish girl who's taken for Germanization. And basically, I ended up weaving all these stories together because I started seeing how often we move children in wartime, but not only in wartime, and without necessarily understanding the effects that has on them. And often it's for some sort of ideological conception or adult thought about where they belong. But no one's asking, like, who are they connected with? And, you know, what really is home for those children, et cetera.
Absolutely. And, of course, this still happens today, this sort
exactly.
of thing. Everything from, I mean, the children who were separated at the border 4 or 5
Ukrainian
years ago.
Children.
Yeah. Children who were given up for adoption, but then the birth parent changes their mind. There's just a lot of different, or even kids who are given into foster care. And then, you know, we want to reunite them with their family, but, you know.
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting because, you know, one part of my story with this child who was taken for Germanization, and that happened to, there's debates about how many children were taken for the purpose of Germanization, but there's arguments that it's in the hundreds of thousands. And then there was this program after the war, the UNRRA actually went to try to repatriate them, like to get them back out of those settings and put them back with their families who were devastated to have them taken. But a lot of those children just didn't remember their first families. They were so young when it happened. They didn't remember. So it was such a hard transition. So when we think of reunification, we sort of have this happy feeling like they'll be back with their family. Or, you know, if a survivor of the war comes back to get their child out of this setting, if they're lucky enough to survive. I met a woman whose father showed up and she didn't know him and she didn't want to go with him. And it was very painful for both of them, for everyone. It's so painful. But these kinds of separations have, you know, all kinds of effects. And it felt really important to like explore it from the child's point of view.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about Germanization. Who were the children being taken? How was it determined?
Yeah.
And where did they take them to?
Yeah, it was this program that Himmler began during the war, Germany's population birth, you know, the birth rate was low and the men were at war. And it was very curious because for Nazis who were so into purity and, you know, you had to be, you know, a pure Aryan person, they ended up doing some weird shortcut where they went into surrounding countries, Slavic countries, where children might pass the caliber tests and the eye charts and the hair color, et cetera, to pass as German. And if they would be brought to Germanization centers and measured in like 60 something places and then they would be re-educated as German. So some of them were in institutions and others, young ones, were put into families. And, you know, also childless couples who had wanted to adopt children thought they were just adopting. They thought they got a child. They didn't realize that that child had been yanked from their parents' arms or from a park or a schoolyard or something in Poland and brought here, you know, to Germany for this purpose. And so it was a really curious and disturbing program, and it affected many, many children. And like I said, the UNRRA then went in to try to get those children back, and they struggled with the same conflict that I raised with the Jewish children when the Jewish operative comes to bring them back to Judaism, because wherever they are, they try to adapt, right? And they ensconce themselves in this new family. And then to be taken away and said, you're going here or you're going there, is another rupture for them. And this woman, Gita Sereny, who wrote about this, she was a UNRRA worker, and she couldn't believe that she had to be a party to this damaging loop, even though, of course, those parents wanted their children back. And maybe ultimately the children would be happy they were back, but it was a terrible transition sometimes. Very, very difficult. And so all of these children in my novel are they're fictionalized characters, but there is like a historical underpinning for each storyline that is, this happened to truly happened to children in these various settings, and they struggled with these issues.
All of the cases here, the original birth parents were gone, had not survived the war, of the Jewish children. And so in some sense, if the parents did survive the war, it's like, well, of course you would reunite the children with them. Of course you would. No, you know, and yes, it could be very hard on the child, but still, you know, of course you would. But when the parents or even no relatives are alive, in one case there was an aunt, you know, and so then, or an aunt or a grandparent or a sibling or something, and then you know, just personally how I would think about this, like, well, yes, it could be really hard on the child, but still, that's better.
Yes.
Better than them being in a, growing up as an orphan and in an institution, even a benevolent one, even a one that where they were well treated, which, you know, which Roger was.
Yes.
For the most part.
Yeah. So these were orphans, and it's what made it really complicated too was, who really did have a claim on those children? I mean, the parents stowed them. In many cases, there was like news of a, you know, liquidation or a roundup, and the, you know, in a ghetto. And so they quickly found a place to harbor, you know, someone, some righteous family would take their kid. And so they stowed them with them, and then they perished. And then, so the adoptive family, such as it is, you know, had them, but it's not like it was official. I mean, they did it as a favor. There were no papers. The parent, they had no, you know, they, now the children have no parents and no papers, and they're stowed with this family. And then this, you know, operative from, you know, an organization for what was called the Redemption of Jewish Children, although it's interesting because that word, you know, has connotations, and there are so many, it turns out when you study this that there were a lot of linguistic disagreements about what you would really call this. So, you know, at some point people were calling it reclaiming the children or retrieving, redeeming, and then some called it ransoming because they were offering money and trying to get them that way. And sometimes they just took the children with, if the family said no, they would just grab them and take them. And so it was a bit lawless, and you know, but everyone felt a kind of moral righteousness or a moral imperative, but like from some outwardly like legal standpoint, it was incredibly blurry. Who did the children belong to? Well, yeah. I don't know. But
and the families that had taken them in sometimes did so at risk to themselves.
At great risk. I mean, they if they had been found out by the Nazis during the war, their whole families would have been killed. And they were risking everything. And they were also often very poor and were giving everything. You know, they were having another mouth to feed. And I mean, and some of the, you know, it was a modeled thing like everything in this world. So in some cases, you know, it was a loving situation and they were very generous. And in others, it was like they were farm hands, extra hands on the, you know, for labor, et cetera. But really, overall, they were risking their lives to save those children, however the conditions. But and then they were, you know, kind of asked to give the children away, back or whatever. And some of them did do so because they were going to get a sum of money to help them. And they were incredibly poor and struggling after the war. But others didn't want to give them up. And they said no. And then it was one of these things where in certain cases, the operative just found a way to take the child. And in other cases, they kept negotiating and wearing them down and trying whatever they could. So it was there were different scenarios for all of this. But
and then to make things even more complicated, where, you know, where were they taking the children? Did they have some place for them to go? And in your story, they wanted to take them to Israel, which they couldn't even get in right away until Israel won its independence.
Yeah, it was very complex. And so sometimes they ended up in like a children's orphanage for a while or a children's home. And then if they could get transit to Palestine, but then the British mandate was there. So they were turning people back and they would end up in Cyprus for a while. And there were, it was a kind of crazy thing. And I was following like real historic routes that these operatives moved along. So the Oscar and Anna storyline follows them, you know, from a part of Poland to a part of Bavaria to Marseille and then on a ship. You know, ending up in Cyprus. So these were really true routes that were taken in the attempt to get them to a kibbutz in Israel.
Wow.
Or Palestine at the time.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jennifer Rosner, author of Once We Were Home.
It was interesting that so many people were willing to take children too, I thought.
Yeah.
And they didn't all end up in orphanages. They were in with families. In this story, in this book, many of them were families. And the families were very loving. And that was, I thought that was good. That was a good thing. How did you find the, were any of these actual stories, or were these all just?
Yeah. I mean, there are historians who, one of whom I was in constant contact with for a while, because she read my manuscript and gave me many comments, and it was, she was incredibly generous, and she had interviewed nearly every operative who had done this kind of movement of children, and many, many of the children who were moved. And there were sort of testimonies and, you know, so I could read interviews and talk to her about the different details. And I mean, like I said, the characters in my novel are very particular fictionalized people, but there are parts of their experience, you know, that are deeply grounded in the historical record. And, you know, okay. It was interesting because the operatives, you know, at the time, as I said, felt this moral imperative, and they were very, you know, they believed it was definitely the right thing to do. But then in retrospect, one of them, at least, you know, had followed all the children he, you know, had moved, and later really questioned whether it was right for all of them. Like, some of them, yes, and they moved and they were happy and they were in Israel and they were Jewish again. And, you know, they felt they found a home, and others never quite adjusted. And so it was just, and really missed that family and etc. And so it was again, like everything, it was varied, and you know, the outcomes were varied.
A lot of shades of gray, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing was black and white, and we wish that when decisions about like this are being made, that you could look at each individual situation and judge it on the individual merits. But you know,
but
how
way,
can you?
Yeah. I mean, it was like we were just after the Holocaust, and, you know, people were, you know, barely, they were just trying to figure out, a lot of the operatives would have maybe gone by themselves to get transit to Palestine, but they felt so worried about leaving Jewish children behind in this, you know, a very dangerous setting. Even if the family, as I mentioned, was loving, there were other people around who were not. And so, yeah, it was a really difficult time, and they didn't have the luxury of interviewing and checking and finding. And it wasn't a fine-grained process. It was like the Jews had been annihilated. We want to get some back. And anyone we can, we want them back. So it was kind of, you know, it was a brush stroke, you know, it wasn't fine, you know, finely tuned.
So I'm sure that many of these children are still alive today. Did you actually speak to any of them?
You know, I was not able to talk to any who had been moved in this particular way. There are a few in Israel, and it became complicated in the pandemic and all these different things. And although I did travel to Israel and get to learn a lot, well, I needed to learn a lot about archaeology too, because
that was going to be my next question. You know, because part of the book, one of the characters is on an archaeological dig in the 1960s, and you have a lot of detail on that. And I wondered, is that something you have a background in?
No, I don't. But I was, again, you know, I went to Israel, and I was lucky that there are generous people who will talk to writers. And I speak with a lot of archaeologists, and I went and saw where it was tricky because of the shift when in the 1967 war, there was a shift of, you know, where people would dig after that because of where Israel and where the borders of occupation were, et cetera. And so like it turned out that an Oxford team wouldn't have dug in the old city where Renata was. So I had her join an Israeli team who was digging. I mean, it became, you had to be kind of careful about all these different technical things, because they were actually truly significant about, you know, people's attitudes toward archaeology in that area at the time. And but I was also so happy to be able to go there for everything, for the sensory experience of Roger walking through the old city, for where he would grow up if his aunt's, you know, I located his aunt's home, though, you know, in a fictional way. I went to a place and I said, this is where it's going to be. So when he walks to school, he passes this church and he passes this, you know, walkway, et cetera, and it smells like the wax from the church, et cetera. And so I was kind of setting him there so that I could understand his life and Renata also. And And I have been to near where his monastery was in France. So those kind of things are really important to me, to kind of be grounded in a setting and, you know, smell it and feel it. And what is the air like? And, you know, those kind of things bring a place to life.
Now, what about life on the, is it kibbutz?
Kibbutz.
How did you research that, what that was like for the children?
Yeah. And again, so we were talking about life on a kibbutz in, you know, in 48, 49, 50, you know, those times. And so it's quite different today. And that's the other thing about being a historical fiction writer. Sometimes, you know, you'll go to a place today, but your novel is set in 1945 or something. And so that's not what it's like. Like I had that in with The Yellowbird Sings when I went to Poland. I mean, I was lucky that I was able to go to a convent that was standing, that had hidden children in a partition, et cetera. And so I got to see exactly how they maneuvered it. And I think it hadn't changed so much, this convent. And I had, you know, I walked in and I smelled the wafting of mushroom soup, and I got to hear how your feet sound on the stone and all these things. But sometimes you go and you're like, this is a modern place and my novel is set, you know, it was 60 years ago or something. But so one thing I did was, there's some books written, really good ones, about life on the kibbutz at that time. So that was lucky, because you could sort of see, this was a time when the communal aspect was so strong that, you know, parents and children were separated because the children were everyone's and the parents were, no one belonged to anyone, you know. And so you would be a child in the children's house, and whoever was on duty that night was the parent in charge. So it was not the same as it is now, where children can live with their parents in a house on the kibbutz. Now, you know, it's different. But at the time it was like that. So, you know, for children like Oscar and Anna, I mean, it might have been, given that they were orphans, you know, they were going to a kibbutz where they were in the children's house, which would probably be very different than if your parents lived on the kibbutz too and you lived in the children's house. But on the other hand, they had lived with the Dubrovskis, and and before that, Anna remembered living with her parents. And so it definitely was a very different experience, although she was a bit older. So even then her experience was different. But, you know, Anna really feels it when she has a child and she says, I never really got to hold on to a mother, and I don't want my children to feel that way. I want them to know I'm their mother, not whoever's on the sign-up sheet. And so she kind of ends up wanting to move out of the kibbutz for this reason, that she hadn't had that kind of bonding and really wanted it.
How long did that last, do you think, on the kibbutzes, where they had the real communal environment?
I think it lasted a while. You know, I don't know. I can't say exactly, but yeah. I feel that even I interviewed some people who grew up on a kibbutz. Oh, they were somewhat, it was a bit later. But they also experienced this very kind of, it was exciting and a little untethered because they were just children roaming around together. It wasn't highly supervised, you know, in a certain way. And it wasn't a one-to-one the way you are with, like, you and your mom. Your mom's keeping track of you, you know, that kind of thing. It was more generalized.
And also there was no, like, personal possessions, really, other than your clothing, I guess. But
no, that's not personal either.
Oh, it covered, wow,
all the laundry. Yeah. And yes, there were kind of almost, you know, the clothes for this age and the clothes for that. And some of the personal things that you brought with you ended up in, like, the box for Purim dress up, or so everyone could use it. Or, you know, and in The Yellowbird Sings, I have the situation that, you know, if your own violin would go into the music room for everyone. I mean, that's just how it was. And so... Yeah.
So it's a very, in some ways, very idealistic society, but yes, most people probably don't really want to live that way.
I mean, there are a lot of people who choose it and love it and feel like it's the best thing, and it's the best thing for our planet and for the universe. And they believe in it as an ideological matter. You know, And then I think probably for children who are being moved and then land there, there's probably a lot to adjust to. And so Oscar had a lot of adjustment because, you know, he was very bonded to the Dabrowskis, the farm family in Poland. They were, in his mind, his parents. And it was very painful for him to be separated from that life that he had and that he, you know, that he knew. And he didn't have any other reference points. Whereas for Anna, who did remember all the rituals, Shabbat dinners and lighting the candles, et cetera, and she kind of came to the kibbutz and felt an affinity or felt that there was a resonance with her past that felt good and rooting, you know, is sort of a way of rooting in. And so for every child, it was different.
Well, Jennifer, why don't you read a little bit from Once We Were Home?
Thanks. So let me say something before I read, because I have these four characters, these four children, Oscar and Anna, and then Roger, who's in the convent, and then Renata, who is a archaeologist digging in Israel. And ultimately, their stories weave together. But for Renata, she is a child who, before she can remember, was taken out of a park in Poland and Germanized. So she was moved on a train. She was put into a Germanization measurement center, et cetera. And then she was put in a family.
Now, I'm kind of surprised you're telling us that, because isn't that a little bit of a, you know.
No, it's not a spoiler, because I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe it is. But the thing is that Renata was holding a little doll in her hand. She had her smallest of her Matryoshka dolls. And the things that she doesn't remember are the things that the Matryoshka doll sections will tell you. So there are sections of this novel that are narrated by her doll, because I wanted the reader to know things about her history that she doesn't know. So how do you get a reader to know something a character doesn't know if you're in that character's point of view? And so that's why I have sections narrated by this Matryoshka doll. So I thought I'd read just three little sections of the doll, just so I didn't want the people listening to have no idea why. Okay, this is the beginning. From primeval forest to ribboned tree, from stout trunk to husked log, I wait. Fine wood shavings drift and swirl, matting the floor like a page upon which stories will be written. I might become a bird with ruffled feathers, a knight astride a whinnying horse, a top that spins around and around. I might become a boy's prized notebook or a girl's tiny doll, solid to the core and brightly painted. When I'm released from the carver's hand, pink circles gloss my cheeks and flowers travel my red coat. My family's song sets the rhythm of my heart as I nest inside my mother, inside her mother, inside her mother. One inside the other, we are gifted to a little girl. She chooses me, the smallest of our set, to take with her wherever she goes. Round-framed eyes, a polka dot behind her ear, it is her lost history that I alone will remember. Together, the girl and I skip and swing on playgrounds and weave through the holiday markets. We marvel at the decorated eggs, bright and intricate. I am painted simply, but the girl doesn't mind. At home, while my family nests, we sit at the table as her mama spoons plum dumplings into bowls and her papa says grace. We're in the park one morning when we spot the toy soldiers. They speak strange words, sharp and halting, their eyes cold like wolves. They are not toys. The girl screams when they grab her. She calls out, "Mama, Mama!" I call out too, thrust inside the girl's pocket, my shouts trapped in the folds of lining and wool. We are jostled and bounced to the steady clatter of a train. Though the girl is measured head to toe and given a different name, she's still the same inside. She reaches for me when we enter a house with the mingled smells of pretzels, burned sugar, and chestnuts. She cries for home, for her mama, but she lets the lady with velvet brown eyes lead her to a table to drink cups of milk, squeezing me tight, my red flowered coat peeling off in her hot, padded grip. In time, the girl will settle here, abandoning me for a toy broken into 100 pieces. She'll spend hours fitting it back together. She will eat the lady's frosted cakes and listen to the man's fanciful stories. Just before sleep, she'll play with me, sugar on my braids. I stand watch, waiting for the girl to return home from school, when a woman coated in olive green steps into the room. Insignias ornament her sleeves, yet she doesn't march like a soldier, and her eyes are soft and sad, not like wolves at all. She walks over to my bureau and stares at me, stares at pictures of the girl. I hear her say, "She belongs to another mother." "No, she is ours, mine." The velvet-eyed lady waves away the woman's papers, ushers her out the door. Later, she packs up the girl, who grips me tight, and we are once again clattering across landscapes. The girl cries, "Please, I don't want to go." I cry too, lost outside my mother, outside her mother, outside her mother, shuttling farther and farther from home.
And that was Jennifer Rosner reading from Once We Were Home. So the characters that you have two boys and two girls that are the characters, and Oscar and Anna Oscar and Anna are sisters, or sister and brother, siblings. Of course, their names change over and over during the book.
Yeah, that makes it a little difficult.
Yes, this situation is complex because there are four characters and their names change and you have to keep track. But that was very true to the history. Their names had to keep changing, uh-huh. Which was very hard for these children too.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was wondering about that story about the picture, the girl and the picture. There was she had a picture, but behind it was another picture. And it was kind of, I wasn't quite sure how that played out, but it sounded like it was interesting. It changed her life, didn't it?
It did. And again, I probably shouldn't say too much about it, but if we're avoiding spoilers, but I do want to say that the idea that children didn't really understand their past was really important to me. Like, so in the case of this Germanization for Renata, I have the doll like letting you know a past that she isn't aware of. And in Anna's case, there are past events that she doesn't know about until she, you know, discovers some things. And I found that in interviewing people, well, and also reading, you know, I had read something in the New York Times a few years ago about a man whose dad was a Holocaust survivor. He never really talked about it. He was very, very quiet about it. But he gifted his son a watch, and the son, you know, wore it. And then one day, you know, years and years later, after his dad had died, the watch broke and he brought it to a watchmaker and they opened it up the whole thing. And there was a photograph behind the watch face. And it was the key to an entire other life that the son eventually discovered about his father, that his father must have wanted this boy to eventually learn, but couldn't talk about it. And, you know, and waited, but, you know, why plant it there? and so mm-hmm. I was inspired by that story to think that, you know, the people who, you know, so Anna's family, the mom's a midwife, you know, and the father in the story, you know, they send them away to stay with the Dabrowskis with several things in their bag. And, you know, and there are keys to some past events that are in that bag that, you know, eventually will be uncovered. Because I think parents like this, when there are secrets, maybe want to make sure their child will at some point find out, but maybe their child is too young, or maybe they can't talk about it, or whatever. So that's partly why there's that photograph.
Okay. Well, it was interesting part of that, though. The other thing that I found really interesting was the Western Wall and what they do with all those, pieces of paper that are in there that people have put in there. I never thought about that, but they had to take some out so that there was room for more to go in. And can you explain what happens to those?
Yeah. at the wall. So there are, you know, people putting in messages all the time, every day. And they put in their prayers and their hopes and their wishes, and people of all faiths are doing that, you know. And then because they want to honor those as prayers, et cetera, someone collects them and they are buried. And they're buried on the Mount of Olives, I believe. And at least that's what I read. And I thought that was really amazing, you know.
It was. Yeah, yeah. I did too.
Yeah.
They weren't just thrown away. I mean, they were, you know, cherished because that
exactly.
Was, yeah.
One of the kind of common elements in this book is woodworking, carving things out of wood, because the dolls like that you just read about, and also one of the characters, Oscar, became a very skilled wood carver. Why, you know, what was the meaning of that for you? Why did you want to include that in this story?
I have a lot of things in my office that are like mementos of my characters, and I even have painted.
Oh, yeah, Jennifer's showing some little car, the top, the little dreidel. I think, and the feather and other things that come from the book,
You know, it's interesting there are several things. One is that the theme of nesting, feeling safe and snug inside where you belong, et cetera, was really important. And I was able to convey that theme by having both Renata have Matryoshka dolls and by Oscar trying to carve these boxes that would nest one inside the other, and that he saw that kind of thing at the Dabrowski's house. And I think they were longing to feel safe and snug and where they fit, somewhere they belonged, and maybe someone to whom they belonged. And so thematically, it was really important. But then, you know, I don't know, Oscar just came to me as this boy who was very outdoorsy and, you know, loved the trees and the birds. And then Wojciech Joseph was going to show him how to whittle, and he became good at woodworking. And, you know, it kind of just developed, his character developed. But it's something else, too, I think. At one point, I feel like there's this way that, you know, maybe through the way trees communicate with one another, maybe the way you touch a trunk and root by root by root, he might be able to get his message to the Dabrowskis, that he, you know, all these kinds of things. There was like this way in which maybe it could connect him, in the same way sometimes where if you look up and see the same star I'm looking at the same moment, you know, there's this feeling like maybe we can be in here together, like in communication. And there's something else which is very personal, which is that, my husband and I are hearing parents of two daughters, both of whom were born deaf. And when we got the news of their deafness, they are not twins, so one and then the other. I started researching in my family tree, and I learned of these great-great-aunts who lived in the 1800s in this little shtetl in Galicia. And
where is that?
Like this area that kind of borders between Austria and Poland. It's a region.
Okay.
The boundaries keep, you know, that country boundaries were changing, but they were kind of in this little region. And the story I learned from some relatives is that when these great aunts had children, they tied a string from their wrist to their babies at night, so that in the darkness, if the baby was crying or fussing, they would feel this tugging on their wrist and they'd wake up to care for their baby. And this string like meant so much to me, this way of hearing or model of mothering that just was really inspiring and important as I was mothering my children. And it was sort of about how you listen to another person, and it doesn't have to be through the, you know, ears, you know what I mean? And anyway, I realized later that in The Yellow Bird Sings, I have a character who's separated from her mother, and she plays violin, and she cracks the window open a little, hoping that the sound of the music is going to somehow, one way or another, reach her mother. And then it only dawned on me when the book was done that the violin is a stringed instrument, and that she was using string.
Oh.
And it was after Once We Were Home was done, too, that I realized that Oscar was touching this tree, like root by root by root, which is also sort of a string imagery to connect, to stay connected. So apparently I write about string.
Also, Oscar made a violin, or the magic box, he made that story too. And storytelling is another kind of important theme to this book. And was that in your other novel as well?
In a way it was, because in the Yellow Bird Sings, and I should mention that there's like a little bit of carryover of character from Yellow Bird Sings to Once We Were Home. So if you read Yellow Bird Sings and then Once We Were Home, there's a little carryover that you might be interested in. But anyway.
Oh, which character? Can you tell me?
The daughter and the mother both appear in this. They're a violinist and her mom.
Okay.
And they're within the Oscar storyline, really. So in any case, when Shira, her name at the time, before she becomes Sophia, is Shira, and she's in the barn with her mother. And she has this bird that, you know, she has like an imaginary bird, and it's telling, you know, she's inventing these stories of how the bird is bravely averting dangers because they're in this dangerous place, and she's gaining control over her life in this way. And then her mom starts telling stories too about a little girl and her bird and how all these things happen. And I realized, like, I think what I was doing there was showing the ways that creativity can save us, the way that you know, our imagination saves us. The way that when you can't move in a barn and have to stay silent, that you can have music playing in your head and that can save you. And you can have a story that your mom's been telling you and that you've been telling that connects you even when you're apart. And there's something about the creative way, you know, through storytelling, through imagination, through music, through poetry, through all kinds of things that did keep people who survived alive. And you know, some of them would write poems on these like husks of leaves, things that, you know, weren't going to serve any practical purpose, but the purpose it served is much bigger than that. It's like the life of your mind and the way certain things in the world could help you keep going. Like, I remember interviewing someone who was walking through the woods trying to survive, and the weather was changing and she wasn't sure she could keep going. And she at some point like scratched this bark of a tree and had the scent of vanilla, and it like this wafting scent of vanilla. And she said, "I smelled that and then I could keep going." And just the way these small things in our world that we could notice and that could sustain us are so important when, you know, survival is on the line.
Wow, that's a really moving image. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was very interested in the fact that the grown-ups, after they had grown up, still wanted to keep in touch with some of their adoptive families. I thought that was, you know, that was good.
Also very true to many people's experience. When I interviewed people who had been harbored by families, many of them were still in touch, if not with the parents, if the parents had died, then with the children or anyone, you know, they wanted that connection because, mm-hmm. you know, they had been saved by that family and felt very connected to them. And
now in Once We Were Home, it wasn't until many, many years later that the children reached back out to the Polish family that had saved them. Was that common, that it took a long time for that reconnection to be established?
I mean, I think there were many reasons or factors. And I mean, the Iron Curtain in Poland was one of them. But even without that, you know, there were different stories I've heard, you know, about people's resilience and the ability to make that connection without falling, you know, being okay enough, stable enough, secure enough, kind of sturdy enough after all the ruptures to kind of reach back out. Some of them would do it right away and others couldn't quite do it for a while, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it really varied. But then there were also logistical issues depending on where they were and how you could make contact, whether you could ever get there physically again, you know, all kinds of things that were in the way.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Jennifer Rosner, author of Once We Were Home. Jennifer, there was something that happened fairly early on where at the Dabrowskis, the Polish farm family, where they found two stones in a nest, I believe. Can you describe what the significance of that was?
Sure. Spoiler alert. So, yes, this was a message that was sent to them to let them know that the parents had perished. They put stones like right by the same part of the road where the carriage had dropped off the children. They left two stones and to kind of convey the information.
And was that a common form of communication, or was that something you made up?
I made it up, but I don't feel like it was uncommon. I mean, I haven't read about that, but it seems to me that people tried in one way or another in especially if the war was still ongoing in a very secretive way, because you couldn't obviously alert. That there would be a messaging, some sort of messaging, so that they knew. And so, you know, that was the other thing that was so important. You know, the fact that people had to hide their identity, that, you know, that Oscar couldn't pee with the boys out on the, you know, outside on the field, and couldn't swim with them either because he was circumcised. Yeah. And, you know, the ways in which he could, you know, Anna was saying, never can you say your Yiddish name, or, you know, no words in Yiddish can come out. We have to only speak Polish. And you had to sort of suppress your identity in this very careful way. And again, also any news, like you couldn't have it that you know, a postcard can't come and let you know what's going on, because if it's especially, you know, during Nazi Germany, you know, during the war, it wouldn't be okay. And so there were a lot of these sort of codes and kind of,
I was going to ask you about the circumcision, because in the States, circumcision was common for non-Jewish kids by the mid-century, you know, by the 40s, it was fairly common here. I just looked up 30% of boys were circumcised in 1900 in the U.S., and it continued to expand from that. But that's not the case in Europe, and still isn't, correct?
Right. And I mean, there it was. I've read that, you know, in the woods, if a Nazi soldier came upon a male, they would, the first thing they did was pull their pants down. Mm. It was like a test, you know, of their Jewishness. So I think if it had been a more widespread practice, that wouldn't be happening.
Right, right. So it's, and I'm wondering why it became widespread in the U.S. but not in Europe. Do you have any idea about it?
I feel like I have heard things about, like, possible eugenic reasons, but I don't know if that's true, or, I mean, if that reasoning was part of it or not.
Well, one thing that I read said that circumcision was banned in much of Europe because of its association with Judaism. And that could be. You know, and we didn't have quite that same history here in the United States. Poland. Is Poland the, was it the setting for your other book?
It was.
Yeah. So what, is your family heritage Polish? Is that what draws you to that, or to that region?
I have family in, you know, that comes from Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and Russia. there's a lot, you know, we come from all over Eastern Europe, and, but, you know, I just, with the Yellowbird Sings, I set it there because there were a lot of, there were movements of trying to get his children, you know, into settings. Like, there was the Zygota network where they were moving Jewish children under, you know, the underground, kind of moving them to convents or to families that would harbor them, etc. And that was happening everywhere probably, but I was sort of found that I could research the situation in Poland. And then I ended up going to Poland and a guide like showed me, you know, a barn where, you know, Jews had hidden and a convent where there was a partition, like I mentioned, where they were hidden there. And I was able to go to the part of the forest, this sort of primeval forest where partisans hid in the countryside, et cetera, and in the woods and the forest. And so I did a lot of research in Poland. And so then I was, you know, it made sense to just build on this massive amount of work that I had done. And as it is, Once We Were Home has a lot of locations. I mean, it has, you know, it's the Rogers Convent is in Marseille. The kids get moved to Bavaria and Marseille. Then Renata's in from Oxford and then going to Israel. You know, there were a lot of settings. Yeah.
That is true. And did you visit all of them?
I've been to Oxford, but not for this, you know, not as a research trip. And I have been near Marseille enough that I could kind of understand Roger's setting. But I explicitly went to Poland and to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, et cetera, and to various places, you know, for Once We Were Home.
How about Cyprus?
I did not go to Cyprus. I would like to go. Yeah.
So, how far apart are Jerusalem and Tel Aviv? Because in the book, it seems like the character, like Renata, gets on a bus, goes for the day to Tel Aviv.
Yeah, you get a bus. Yeah. It's a small place. I mean, I think Israel is about the size of Rhode Island.
Ah, okay. So it's not very far away.
You can get on. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I think that's correct. I hope I am right. forgive me. Yeah. But you can definitely travel between those two cities, you know, no problem.
So as you were writing these four different storylines, did you write like all of one and then all of another and then weave them together? Or did you go back and forth as they show up in the book?
Yeah. Neither and both. So, you know, my first experience with this kind of the kernel of the story happened when I had met that operative for the redemption of Jewish children. And I began the Oscar and Anna storyline first. And in some ways I thought that might just be this novel. It would be about those two, you know, in this particular situation. But then as I learned about the case, there was this famous case of the Finley brothers who had been sort of essentially stolen by the church to stay within Christianity. And they were, you know, harbored and there was court orders and clergy went to jail, et cetera. There was that whole case of moving children. And then I learned about the Germanization. I decided that I'm going to make this a, you know, much wider story of children being moved. And so I started beginning with, you know, I started writing the Roger and Renata. And I wasn't writing them all in separate columns. Like it wasn't that I had, you know, but I also, you know, the order that they appear took a lot of thinking about whether, you know, when to move from this story to that story so that you weren't in like a tight ping pong game, but rather, you know, there was like you've settled into this storyline enough and now you're able to move to the other one. It's complicated, these braided stories, and finding the sort of exact right place to move a reader's mind from one to another, and how to create little small, you know, connections that carry over so that the transition is smoother. And it's a structural question for every writer who writes a braided story.
Yes, and I can imagine it's really challenging. And how you actually, like, at what point did you know how the stories would sort of come together, like Renata and Rogers? Was that planned all along, or did it just sort of develop through the writing?
Yeah, it developed through the writing. I don't love to know. When I try to plan in advance, I find the writing becomes contrived because you're sort of writing with this very particular end point in mind. I know a lot of people are very successful who outline work, but for me, the organic nature of it and the sort of the movement of whatever my unconscious mind is doing in all this feels really important. And it usually feels much more organic to just let it happen, even though it's also anxiety provoking.
And,
you know, because you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just writing out these scenes and hoping that there's going to be a connection. And you sort of have to just have this faith that your mind you know, that there's like a web aspect that, you know, it's all going to connect eventually, and that there's a reason you're writing this scene and that scene and this scene. And there was a writer who had said something about how, you know, writing scenes is like putting stars out into the sky, and then later you can draw any number of lines that are the constellations. And you don't, you know, maybe the more, you know, getting out the scenes and then figuring out what story you're telling is one way to go, you know. And
oh, that's great.
That kind of helpful, you know, I found it comforting.
So that's sort of what you do.
Yes, I think I just sort of write moments for a long time, just like moments of these lives. And then I think, okay, sometimes they get all moved around. Sometimes they get deleted. You know, sometimes you realize you have to add several moments in order for this to connect to that. But the start is just writing out, you know, and yeah.
Yeah. So how long did you spend on this book from start to finish?
It's really hard to say, because I feel like so much of the research I did for The Yellowbird Sings helped me with this one. So sometimes I think it's like an average of the two. So The Yellowbird Sings, from the very beginning to the end, was like a 10-year journey. And I mean, of course, I had, you know, I had young children, and my parent, I had a sick dad, and you know what I mean. It's like, it's not like 10 years stiff, you know.
Right.
Writing. Yeah. But on the other hand, I was thinking about it, working on it, trying for about 10 years. And then this one, I think, was about 3 years. But I think on average, they were both 5.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? Because I borrowed.
Right. Yeah. And now, are there things that you discovered in the research for both these books that are going to come into another novel?
I don't know. I'm working on a new novel that is not in this time period, and it doesn't pertain to any of these characters. And it's a completely, it's a novel in the 2000s in the California coastline. And so it's really different. But who knows, you know, whether these things sort of come back in circles, because the new novel is about a child who wakes up after a high fever and can't hear. And so that's circling around for me.
Yes.
And
yeah.
You never know what will come back to be a motivator to sit down and write something. I don't know.
Absolutely. Well, Jennifer, we're about out of time. And I just want to thank you for being with us today. We really enjoyed having you and learning about Once We Were Home, and about what happened with these children who had been taken from their homes, and for often, sometimes very good reasons and sometimes very bad reasons. But it gives you a lot to think about, and it's a beautifully written book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated talking to both of you.
And Caroline, do you have some closing words for us?
Well, there was one quote from the book that I found interesting. It's when Oscar and Anna went back to where they had been housed and loved and taken care of, that she's confused because she doesn't know if she's Jewish or if she's Christian because of the difference. And so he says, God is all of ours, if God is any of ours. And I think that's a wonderful quote.
Thank
God
you.
Is all of ours, if God is any of ours.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. And we'll see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you so much for having me.